This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody, welcome to the Western Rookie Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and thank you for being patient with me over the course of the last couple weeks. I've had to relaunch some, I call them From the Vault episodes, where I pull episodes from, you know, a handful of years ago, and I replay them just because for two reasons. One, I've had some scheduling snafus. Two, I really do feel like, I believe one of the last ones we talked about e-scouting and how to use digital maps to enhance your hunt, your non-resident hunts. So I thought that was very important to relive some of that information. So there's that. Today's guest, Mr. Jaden Bales. Jaden, what's up, man?
Hey, how are you, Dan?
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. So I don't know, how close are you to some of these fires that are happening out west?
Dude, right now I'm living in the little green spot that, like, there is no good fires or big fires, I guess you could say, around me in Montana. But boy, there's some big ones going up in Nevada, yeah, and Utah and Colorado. It's not good. Some folks lost their lives here recently fighting those, yeah, fires. They're getting pretty nasty. And it doesn't, yeah, look, I was just watching the forecast this morning. Doesn't look like there's much relief there for that, you know, Nevada, Utah, Colorado corridor. Really anytime, yeah, soon.
Man, it just, every time since I've been paying attention, right, to Western hunting, which has only been since about 2014, maybe 13, is when I started thinking, hey, I want to go experience some of this stuff. It just seems like every single year, and maybe this is just normal out there, that they're like big fires are a part of life now out west.
Yeah, I think it just changes around where experiences the big fires, right? Like this year, it's going to be the Utah-Colorado show, it feels like. Maybe, yeah, Arizona and New Mexico too. But I remember, so when I was a kid and into early college, mm-hmm, we ran contract firefighter rigs for wildland fire. Mm-hmm. And I remember 2013, I was like, out of college or out of high school and was like helping move some of these machines like around to different fires and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so 2013, dude, it was a busy year in Oregon, right? Yeah. And like, as I'm looking at the map now, I don't even see any current fires going on in Oregon, which is a huge, mm-hmm, huge relief at this stage. Same with like Idaho. We had a bunch of stuff going in Idaho and Northern California. Yeah. All those places, you know, are doing pretty good right now. Fingers crossed, knock on wood. Yep. So I think it just moves around year to year, but it's always a constant battle out the west. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I want to talk about real quick is, how close are you to the legislation, is it Oregon or Washington, where they want to axe everything? They want to, if it has to do with animals, they want to axe it, like farming practices, like no hunting, no bug spray, no, like that, you know, like I forget what the actual piece of legislation is called, but that craziness.
So it's IP 28, which is an initiative petition 28, and it would criminalize hunting, fishing, trapping, and farming. Man, the frustrating thing is, so this bill has been coming up for a long time, like, mm-hmm, at least 4, 5, 6 years. I'd have to look back, the first time I saw it. But the point is, it's been coming up again and again and again, and it seems like they just try to keep getting more signatures so that it keeps getting more press. And I'm a little nervous that, like, the fact that we're giving it so much press is maybe helping it on the other end of the spectrum. I don't know.
Yeah.
For sure. But yeah, it's called the Peace Act, which, there's always a question of like, how much are people actually reading into what they're signing on to when they sign these petitions, right? Like, would you like to sign the Peace Act? Like, of course, most people want to do that, but I don't know how detailed people are getting into saying, like, oh, yeah, this would end not only hunting and fishing and trapping, but it would end, you know, normal farming and agricultural practices as we know it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, man, it's been wild to see how much steam this thing's gotten over the last few years.
Yeah, it's crazy. And so I think you're 100% right. I think what's happening is the old bait and switch is happening where people are going, hey, dude, peace. Oh, peace means war. I don't want war. No one wants war. I'll sign that. Yeah, cool. And no one reads it, right? Uh-huh. So I'm guessing there's a lot of that going on. But at the same time, like, imagine this going through somehow. I'm just saying, I don't ever see it going through. Like, I don't see politicians, even in the most extreme politicians, voting farming out of existence in a state. Then if it does get voted on and somehow passes, imagine enforcing that. Imagine walking up to a giant ranch with thousands of head of cattle and going, you are no longer allowed to raise cattle.
You'd have some serious civil disobedience on.
Oh, my God. There would be like mini wars being fought over this. Like, like, you want to talk about a group of people who don't take shit? Ranchers and farmers, man. Like, I don't know. And so I can remember when I first heard about this, what I want to say, like, as far back as 10 years ago, someone was telling me, hey, dude, there's a group of people out there that are trying, he used this as the example, that are trying to outlaw mouse traps. I'm like, what? It's like, yeah, any form of killing an animal, whether it's bug spray or stuff, they're trying to get rid of it. And that's what this has evolved into, is this next phase of all of this. And it just blows my mind what psychopath is leading the charge on this. Just, it's crazy.
Yeah, man. And like, I think that at the end of the day, the strategy is always just to move the center, right? Yeah. They're just trying to get the center that actually has weight in voting to move further in the extreme. It's always a good reminder, like, especially, you know, when you're looking at cross legislation in different states, like, as a hunting public, you know, we do have to keep a pretty good public facing image, because, like, man, I want to make sure people who could be swung one way or the other still, like, land on our side of things, because I think this is just going to be a constant battle, you know, going forward. It just is the way that the world is crumbling. The cookie's crumbling.
Yep. I do have another question. Maybe, you know, this just popped into my head. Maybe you know the answer of it. Maybe you don't. But I know that in certain states, if you want to film your hunts and post it on YouTube, you have to have some kind of permit or permission slip. Do you know anything about that?
So if you're on national forest, and especially in wilderness, you're supposed to have gotten permits. That whole process kind of got dozed. When I say that, like, Department of, man, I can't even remember off the top of my head. But the idea is, like, I don't think recently it's either been enforced, or it, even if it was enforced, or if it even is a thing anymore. So I think it's worth looking into. But for previous hunts, I've had to go in and get some, like, permitting for national forest stuff. But I was told recently, and I haven't since in the last 24 months or 12 months, had to look into any of that. So,
okay. Well, yeah, maybe it's one of those things where it's just like, how do you even, that's a law, but how do you enforce it? Like, is the United States government paying people to just watch YouTube videos all day and then fact check these people to see if, like, what a waste of money. You know what I mean?
Certainly not. I mean, if anything, like, you know, talk about, like, odd situation to be, like, allocating resources to the national forest right now, where we are so human resource limited and just overall resource limited on fighting wildfires or preventing, like, massive wildfires in the first place, right? Like, managing forests. But then it's like there's some of these other like nitpicky things that I'm like, I don't know if we need to be managing that part of this equation very closely. So anyway, it's just like you said, it's a weird, complicated, like commingling of agencies that we're always working with in the hunting world.
That's a fact. I have a question about fire that I'm going to ask you, but I do have to say thank you to the partners of the podcast real quick. So, I've been shooting wasp broadheads now. I think it's been 14 years now. I took a small break to experiment with two other broadheads in that time frame for like one or two seasons, and then I just kept coming back to wasp. So, in my opinion, they're some of the best broadheads on the market. Most of their heads are still made in the United States. And my favorite part about working with wasp is that whenever I shoot an animal with them, there's a ton of destruction. They cause a ton of destruction. And so that's the goal, especially for archery equipment. So if you want to find out more about wasp broadheads, go visit wasparchery.com. And I do have a discount code for 20% off, and that is NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Montana Decoys. The thing that I like that Montana Decoys, their decoys are light, they're packable. You can smush them down, you can put them in a backpack, you can pull them out, and then really be mobile with them. And the goal ultimately is to get inside that animal's bubble. Right. And decoys can help you do that. Go check out MontanaDecoy.com. Next on the list, we have a new partner this year, Vortex Optics. I've been running Vortex for years. Everything I do is Vortex. Spotting scopes, binoculars, rangefinders. Dude, I don't know what it is. I don't know if you feel this way, Jaden, but like sitting on the top of a hill, watching the sun come up, glassing for mule deer or any whatever wildlife you're doing, dude, I love that little part of my day before the stalks happen, before you move in on the animals, the sitting there watching the mule deer materialize out of nothing, and then the chase is on from that point. And so I got my spotter and my binoculars, and I don't know, man, that's my favorite.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing that beats it, man. I was just out. I was scouting, not too long ago, and like I said that to my buddy who I was up there on the glassing knob with. It was like, dude, this is just my favorite. We haven't even seen anything yet, but like watching watching the sun go down and being like, man, this is awesome. That's awesome.
Absolutely. And so go check out vortexoptics.com, and you pair a good glassing knob with a jet boil and some instant coffee, and dude, that's a win for me. Like I love making the coffee out there, the spotting scope set up, and it's just a thing. Like it's a vibe is what they say. So
it's a vibe.
Okay, Jaden, we talked a little bit about fires. From your experience, once a fire goes through an area, how long before wildlife starts to move back in and take advantage of all the new growth?
Okay, so this is a great topic. One, I'm wearing my wildfire hat. It's like a fire prevention hat. My brother does this stuff for a living, so I have like a direct line into this. Yep. This is cool. But the other thing is, what day is this coming out again?
This is going to come out tomorrow, July 2nd.
Okay, great. So this is pertinent. I've got a specific example that I really, really like.
Okay.
In 2022, over the 4th of July weekend, we got a bunch of thunderstorms. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't fireworks that sparked a fire, but it was a lightning strike, sparked this fire in an area that I'd already been hunting or scouting. So on the 4th of July, this fire comes through and I'm like, dang it, that's burning up my spot. Mm-hmm. We got it put out, and it was a pretty, I don't know, four or 500 acre fire, something like that. And then we started getting some, with those thunderstorms that started the fire, there were some additional ones that had some moisture in it. Mm-hmm. And on July 16th, I went in there. So this is only 12 days after the fire started and then was put out a couple days later. So within 2 weeks after the fire had been put out, I went in there and I was glassing, and I found this group of like 10 bucks in there. And that group of 10 bucks that was using the burn that had just been put out. My brother and I ended up killing $2 out of that group later in the fall. Two nice deer. One was my best deer that I'd killed at the time. Mm-hmm. And like the other one was a really good 4-point my brother shot. And it was just like an eye-opening deal. So it was like, okay, well, we had a burn come through and then we had some moisture over the top of it and some deer moved right in because it ended up having this little tiny green shoots, this little like golf course mm-hmm. green shoots. And they love it, man. They moved right in. It also wasn't such a big fire that it was a moonscape that it created. So there was still cover nearby that they could come in and out of the burn scar pretty easily to feed and still have some cover.
Okay. All right. So it wasn't like in the, let me ask this. In the past, do you use knowledge of where fires were as a scouting tool of places to go check for that upcoming hunting season?
100%. And so basically going into that fire, right afterwards was something that I had, it was like a theory I'd been testing for a while. And then that one really confirmed it. Right.
Right.
But I'd rather be the first person in a burn, than the last person to come hunt a burn.
Gotcha.
In 2021, actually, my brother and I hunted and my dad hunted this burn from 2013. Actually, it was a burn that we had worked when we were doing the contract wildland stuff.
Okay.
And we elk hunted this thing and it was a big, big burn. And so we were, 8, 9, 10 years after it this place had burned, and it had kind of gotten grown up so much that it was really hard to kill in there because the reproduction timber was tall. And so you could glass into it and see elk, but then you couldn't get on the same side and then pick them up again.
Yeah.
And that was a really good lesson of like, okay, I would rather have been in here a little earlier. And even in that one fire complex, you had different levels of vegetation. So like on the east side of it, of that fire, it was really thick, but then on the west side, it was still rocky and not a lot had grown up in it. So, long story short, I key in on burns, but I also want to key in on the kind of burn that can help you kill what you're looking for.
Gotcha. Is there like a time frame where fire is like, hey, year one is okay, but year two is better? Or does that matter at all to you?
The thing that matters to me most like is probably like what time frame are you trying to hunt?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, are we talking, and let's make an example up here. Are we talking deer, elk, and rifle or archery?
Gotcha. I don't know. You tell me. Like,
okay, so let's do archery elk because I think that one's the one that most people are like stoked on, right?
Okay.
For the most part with archery elk, man, you're still going to want to have some cover nearby. Right? Because like elk are going to hit the thick stuff and they're going to find a place to bed that's not very sunny.
Mm-hmm.
So you either have to have a fire that has like a mosaic of like unburnt stuff in there,
mm-hmm.
or you're going to be at the edges of it.
Okay.
But then if you're getting 8, 9 years down the road, you've got enough thickness in that center of the fire that they could be in the center of it. So I more just want people to think about like what they're focusing on in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go to the edges of a fire as soon as I can. Like, it might even still be, I mean, I'm going to exaggerate a little bit, but there might even still be black smoke in the center of it, and I'm going to be glassing the edges because I think that critters really like moving back into those fires.
Like, almost immediately?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you think that is? I look at a fire, and I feel out of here. I'm like, fire's coming, we're out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think they come back so quick?
You know, there's some really good collar data out of Utah that the wildlife prof, I think is his name on Instagram, has like posted. I think a big piece of it is just like anytime. So we used to do this as farmers growing up. We would burn our grass fields, and then immediately after the grass field burns, like it just revitalizes grass to come back up.
Right,
and it's that really nutrient dense early shoots like.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it from like an agricultural perspective, it's high in protein content. Yeah. And I think that even if it's all blackened and like looks like it's scorched earth, but there's these little green shoots coming up. Those are the most nutritious, like, pieces of food on the mountain that any of these animals can find. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be attracted to it. The cover part, like the safety part, is probably where you have to account for the fact that they're going to be on the edges of it, because they want to be able to dip into some thicker cover if they have to.
All right, guys, you know me, and I love eating wild game, but I don't eat wild game every single night. Every once in a while, I'll reach for a side of beef, and that's why I trust Omaha Steaks. Because Omaha Steaks are sent directly to my door, I can keep my freezer stocked without having to go to the grocery store. It's honestly like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop right at your house. Last week, I pulled out their pure ground ribeye burgers for a quick grill session. The flavor and marbling was unreal, rich, juicy, and miles ahead of any average grocery store meat. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF, for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan and Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
Gotcha. Okay. So it's more to do with the nutrient rich sprouts that come from that. And so when a fire is put out, like, are you talking 24 hours? I mean, how long have you, or what was the time frame that from the time that the fire came through to the sprouts started? Is there a specific number of days that you've seen that in?
So most of the time there's a closure, mm-hmm. right? Like wildfire crews are yep. doing mop up, mm-hmm. there's a closure in there. And so usually you can't get in there for a week or 10 days anyway, just cause they're doing this like mop up.
Gotcha.
And I think that people are going to find more issues getting into places because of closures for human safety than they are going to have like the ability to get in there very quickly.
Okay.
So, all right. Like, especially I've got clients and friends who are hunting California right now, and every single one of them gripes about how National Forest is getting shut down to road access yeah. because of a fire that's a long ways away. So yeah. it just is going to also depend a little bit on the state and the forest that you're in.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Is there a species that returns to fire quicker, like mule deer or elk or antelope, than faster than the other?
Man, I can't say that I've like sat down and tried to create a timeline really, or a time frame. I just have noticed that they all three, deer, elk, and pronghorn, end up back in the burn scars pretty quick.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I think it's all just like food related.
Yeah.
But there was some fires in northeast Wyoming 2 years ago in 2024. And I had a client of mine who had a pronghorn tag out in those areas that burnt.
Yep.
And he shot his in the black. So the fire ended August 21st and he killed it in the black just like a month later. So.
Wow. Wow. That's crazy. And so it just sounds to me like from a e-scouting or non-resident standpoint, if you're going in for a week, to whatever zone you've drawn for whatever species you've drawn, that mm-hmm. knowing where fires are could be very beneficial to where to go or where not to go.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And maybe, maybe there's an element of this too, that like there were animals there before and you couldn't see them until it burned. And then all of a sudden it opened it up and then you're like, oh, there they are. You know, it's like pulling back the veil of like, oh, there's some animals here that you can see now. Maybe there's an element of that. I don't know. It's like how you control for that unless you just have trail cameras on the ground. But I like it. The interesting thing is though, and I don't know how much we want to get into this about our poor draw luck between me and my good buddy.
Yep.
But I was in an area that we're going to be hunting in Northern California. And I saw a fresh burn on the map and I was like, oh, this is, you know, again, I'm going to go right in there and see what's in there.
Yep.
One, I did bump a bunch of deer while I was hiking around in there and I was like, nice, they're in here. But all of it burned so quickly that all of the underbrush burned, but the trees are still alive and the canopy is still intact. And I was like, oh, I can't glass into any of this. Like, this is not that helpful.
Yeah.
So it's important to know where you're at, like what kind of a burn you're dealing with, because some of those places, you don't open up the canopy.
Right. Can you find that information? Like, do they have a burn, I don't know, categories?
Like burn severity.
Yeah, severities. Like, oh, this was only a level one. It just quickly came through, burned a little bit of stuff, but.
I'm trying to remember if there's like a good civilian, accessible thing. Most of the time I just, look through and do like a recent imagery, just to see how it went. But, usually you can pretty well guarantee if you see like a low country burn that like blows up really quickly, that it probably didn't burn super hot. Like if it's mostly sagebrush, juniper, like it's going to come through pretty quick and then die out.
Yeah.
Whereas you have this cottonwood fire, for instance, in Utah, I think that sucker is burning pretty hot because it's been going a while and it's moving fast across timber.
Yeah.
Really thick, long, I think they would say like long fuel hours. That you have there.
Makes sense. I don't know why that popped into my head, but I'm glad we talked about it because that would be, I always assumed, dude, stay away from fires. If there's fires there, maybe they're good the following season, but not that same season, right? But it sounds like I'm wrong. So I'm glad we talked about it.
Yeah, and I mean, but again, I think there's some elements of safety that people should pay attention to, whether it's like widowmakers in trees or trees falling over. Or just making sure that the National Forest or BLM or whoever is actually letting you get in there.
Yeah. So. Things to be aware of.
Things to be aware of. Yeah. Yeah,
for sure. Okay. Now, a while ago, we had this conversation. We were going to have a conversation and you're like, dude, I don't know if I'm necessarily ready to talk about this as far as some of the information that we were going to talk about. But now, I believe you do have some updated information from us from like tag allocations, maybe some leftover tags, specific states where some rules and regulations potentially changed. Is that correct?
Yeah. A big thing that most people know me for is my thumb is on the pulse of what's happening in Wyoming pretty good.
Okay.
And I will say this, like coming out of the tag draws, the Western Wyoming, you know, Region G, H, K, like the tag draws there had some serious point creep, and especially in the top end deer units as well. The point creep that happened out there was pretty brutal. Largely, so the biggest thing that you can point to is like, one, you've got more people hopping back in.
Mm-hmm.
Who like want to apply for these tags.
Yep.
For instance, we had, you know, in 2022, we had like roughly 900 people applying in the random draw in H, and this year we have like 1,000. So there's more. There's 100 more people.
Yep.
The big difference though is like we have fewer tags. And the Game and Fish Department the last few years has been pushing for increases in non-resident licenses where they feel like they can. And for the most part, the public in Wyoming says like, no, thank you. We'd rather just keep our extremely low numbers of non-residents at what it is. And so that just pushes so much upward pressure on the applications. You know, just 2 years ago, Region H was more like your, it's like 4 or 5 year type application. Now it jumped to 9 in the regular. Yeah. So, you know, about doubled in like 2 years, which is really brutal. That's really brutal.
That's crazy. That's crazy. So I heard some statistics about the state of Wyoming where a majority of their funding comes from non-resident tags and tag applications and sales of that kind of stuff, just because of the population of Wyoming. Is that still accurate?
Yeah. You know, last time I looked, it was like non-residents were about 70% of all license income for Wyoming. The where the rubber meets the road, though, and this is very much a danged if you do, danged if you don't type situation. Right. Where the rubber meets the road is like non-residents are still willing and able to keep paying higher prices and keep playing the game, even when they're kind of getting screwed. So, you know, I think a lot of people you'll see on social media or Instagram or whatever, where like they'll be like, well, Wyoming just doesn't need my, you know, doesn't need my money anymore. And the rest of us who are in the game are like, great, man. That's it makes it easier for us to get a tag, you know? So at the end of the day, it's just a revolving door of like, and basically every Western state's this way, like, they kind of have non-residents by the short hairs because the Western hunting experience is limited in the amount of people that can go do it every year.
Yeah. So you, when you say certain groups of people you feel like are getting screwed, you're talking about the non-resident.
Yeah. Largely. Okay. Yeah. There's not really a state in the West that is really helping the non-residents much. I haven't seen, you can pick and choose some small examples of like little increases for non-residents. For instance, like Wyoming just implemented an unlimited cow tag in some highly privatized areas, which so for people who have access there, maybe that's a little bonus for you. But overall, man, the trend is not in the non-residents' favor.
Yeah. And that's a trend across the entire country for every state, east, west.
Yeah.
Dude, it's just like the residents. And I can't, like, I come from Iowa, right? And I hunt on a piece of property that is surrounded by non-resident landowners. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so they still have to go through the draw process in order to get that. And so as a resident, living in a state that has a very coveted tag, right? I get it, right? But at some point, I'm all for non-resident hunting. I'm all for residents being able to speak their voice about the natural resource in their state. But at some point, there's going to be a tipping point where the 1,000, the 2,000, whatever, however many $1,000 elk tags that you're buying becomes like the supply and demand is gonna shift and people are not going to pay X number of dollars for those tags anymore, especially if you're a non-resident, because the dollar amount versus the experience is not there anymore.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting though, is like, I don't know if we have, if we have much evidence that we were getting very close to it yet, right?
Exactly.
Like Wyoming just increased their special price to $1,200 for deer and pronghorn. It's like basically $2,000 for an elk special tag. And, you know, in the elk world, especially the areas that have less public access, you saw it get you into a tag pretty quick. But when it came down to the, like, most public land areas with some just generally good elk hunting, like general elk hunts, didn't really shift the ability to get those tags by more than like a year or two to have a $2,000 elk tag versus a $700 elk tag. And I'm just looking back here and like Region G in the special draw still took 10 points to guarantee it this year. So people are waiting 10 years to go hunt deer in a herd that is a third of the size as it was 4 years ago and you know, way more expensive.
Yeah. So that brings me to the question of people have invested. It's like for me, mm-hmm. I have invested 12 years of accumulating preference points. I think this year will be my 13th preference point I'm going to be buying for a variety of species. And so I've hit a point where I'm going to continue because I'm just that far into it, and that it would be pointless of me to not spend that money on the tag because of the amount of time, right? So I'm kind of at a stage where it's just like, dude, I got to spend the $2,000 to get an elk tag, because what is all of this worth then? Nothing. What am I going to do? Just quit? You know what I mean? Yeah. But the thing about it, though, is that at the end of the day, do you feel like people are going to start reeing up again once they cash in all their preference points? And then we start to see like a slip down in like the opposite of point creep happen?
You know, I wish I knew what the structure of ages of people mm-hmm. who are coming into the point game. But, you know, a few years ago, I was sitting in on this Wyoming Wildlife Task Force. Mm-hmm. And one of the important pieces of this equation is the amount of baby boomers that we have who are in these point games. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, like most baby boomers were at a place where they were maybe in their 40s or 50s when these point systems got started. Mm-hmm. And they oftentimes got in on the floor. And now these guys are, you know, 70, 80 years old. And I love guiding them. They're great guys. Like, I don't blame them, because they were sold this system that meant that they were going to get X, Y, or Z at the end of it. Just didn't mean, I don't think they planned on being, in a wheelchair by the time they got their elk tag.
Right.
Here's the thing. Those folks are going to be just like not hunting or applying anymore at some level.
Yeah.
I've helped a couple of different hunters go on their last elk hunt.
Yeah.
Because they're just like run out of time.
Yeah.
It's an unfortunate reality of where a lot of these people are. I don't know how much of like the baby boomers exiting the hunting space is going to offset like more people coming in who are younger. Mm-hmm. But I see a world where we have to be cognizant of it, because it could really, if anything, it could really hurt our overall hunter numbers. Doesn't matter if you're talking Western hunting or people out east.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, just like all things, my gut tells me there's a potential, not necessarily a crash coming, because right now people are, they're buying their preference points, they're buying the tags. But at some point, I just feel like if the residents keep saying no to additional tags or limitations, people are just going to be like, well, Wyoming's out. Like, it's so tough. I don't want to go through that route anymore, which just budgets for wildlife crash. Does that make sense? And does that sound like a reality?
You know, it's a big thing you're seeing in Wyoming right now. It's part of the reason why you saw these like price increases, mm-hmm. because with populations decreasing from the winter in particular, they cut a bunch of tags. Like, again, like Region H and G are half of what they were at 2022 right now. And as a result, they had budget shortfalls and have had to make other decisions to make that money up.
Yeah.
I think we're already seeing it, because there's not really a world, unless it's maybe elk and coyotes that like we're having, and whitetails, that we're having a bunch of other opportunities show up to hunt species. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, I think it's something we got to pay attention to. In fun fact, in like 2008, in the financial crisis, 2008-2009, Idaho did not sell all of their non-resident tags.
Yeah,
and as a result, they implemented this opportunity for residents to buy a second tag at non-resident prices.
Yeah.
And that was only 15, well, I guess you're getting closer to 18 years ago, 17 years ago, where they weren't selling out of enough. And like they had kind of gone backwards in demand and in a way that they changed this regulation. So it's certainly, there's a world where this all could happen. Haven't seen any indication of it yet, but I think, anything could happen depending on what's going on in our economy and in our world too.
Yeah. Is your business a direct reflection of the current economy? Like how many people call you in a given year and want your services?
I don't know, man. It seems like hunting lives in a very, like, people's hunting time ends up being the last thing that they cut, right?
It's a priority for a lot of people.
It's yeah. Like, specifically people like us who are putting a lot of time and energy and effort into it. Like,
yeah.
It means a lot to our, not just to our, like, vacations, but, like, it means a lot to our lifestyle.
Right.
It seems like, for the most part, it's been pretty impressive to see it just, like, keep increasing in demand. But it also is probably driven by supply, right? Maybe if we had a glut of supply, it would be a little bit more fluctuating.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Outside of that, are there any other like things that have changed in the past? I know you mentioned some tags that this is where, so let me see, how do I say this? You said that the Department of Natural Resources for Wyoming wanted to increase tags to non-residents. The residents said, no, we do not want more non-residents in our state. But then do those tags get pushed to the residents for additional options for residents?
No, because it's an over-the-counter tag for residents. And therefore, like, they can't just sell more resident tags. I mean, this is the interesting situation of a state that has over the counter. When they have really good deer numbers or buck numbers in this case, like their ratios are increasing rapidly because they've had some of the best fawn recruitment that they've had in generations following that hard winter. They can't increase the license number because it's just at the public's will. You know, they can't put more people in there because the game and fish departments have like these management criteria to manage to a certain level of bucks in a herd, to manage to a certain level of does in a herd, like these things. So when you basically are saying like, hey, biologists, like we hear you, you're trying to manage to your buck ratio objective. We're just going to say, don't increase non-resident tags. You're going to overshoot that.
Yeah.
You know, and most people, are totally fine. If you're a resident, you're like, I can get the tag and go anyway. I want there to be too many bucks or more bucks than the biologists want out on the landscape. Yeah. But you're leaving a lot of the game and fish department based on how they want to manage herds is leave an opportunity on the table by not increasing those non-resident tags.
Okay. And the fact that residents have hit their limit as far as who is buying the tags, because they're already buying tags, they would then, they're all, like the population is just like the resident, the number of residents is lower than the number of tags that need to be allocated.
Basically the way that they manage a resident over the counter hunt in states like Idaho or Wyoming is they'll lengthen or shorten the season dates, or they'll mess with in Wyoming, they do a lot of antler point restrictions, and then they're testing some like weapons restrictions in Idaho.
Yeah.
So that's how they manage how much interest residents hunting have in that area.
Right.
So for instance, they also proposed getting rid of the antler point restriction in region G and H this year. But again, residents were like, nah, let's keep that antler point restriction on there. Even though biologically they didn't see a real need to keep it on.
This is crazy. Because it sounds like what's happening is management is being overrun by, it's almost just like you're a wildlife biologist, okay? You do the research, here's the science, I'm going to put it forward, here's my suggestion. And then me, Tom, Dick, and Harry show up and go, oh, we don't care about that. We want things to stay exactly like they are, or we want to change it for better for us. Sounds like what's happening.
Yeah. And if you sit at the commission meetings, you'll hear a lot of people say like, well, we ended up finding this in 1987 when we did this. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to it, you know, like, and just keep it going. So we end up back at this place. Instead of looking at where the herd is in recent history and how things are going currently, they oftentimes have a stake planted in the ground of what they wanted things to be like based mm-hmm. on 1991.
Yeah.
Or 83 or whatever the case is.
Yeah.
So yeah, man, you end up with a lot of people doing that. And it's very interesting when hunters are fighting so hard for science-based management of grizzly bears and wolves and mountain lions in Colorado, whatever else, right? We're fighting so hard, beating the science-based management like drum. But then when it comes to our ungulates, you know, we know better than the biologists. And yeah. It's a hypocrisy, I think, that's going to bite us in the ass.
Yeah.
Excuse my language.
I feel like that will also be a tipping point where all of a sudden the Department of Natural Resources will go, hey, guess what? You got what you asked for, right? And then you have skewed sex ratios. You have disease come through places. You have like all of the bad things that people don't want on the landscape, they're going to get because of greed, essentially. Does that sound fair to say?
I think the biggest like thing, you nailed a bunch of really important downsides mm-hmm. of like not using hunters to manage wildlife populations.
Yep.
The biggest thing I'm concerned about, though, is not having enough hunters who have a finger on the pulse of what's happening on the ground. And you're either going to get like some federal legislation that is going to override wildlife management in a place like Wyoming, and we're not going to have enough non-resident people to help us beat it back, right?
Yeah.
And like people paying attention to these things.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm really nervous, like, you know, in a world where the proportion of hunters to non-hunters is decreasing, I'm like, this isn't a good move to just like tighten down on opportunity around every corner.
So. Yeah. You're familiar with the Milk River, right? And mm-hmm. like the glory days of the Milk River, with the amount of whitetails, Western whitetails that were there, and just like it was this gem that nobody really knew about, and the extremely high populations of deer that lived up and down that, and then EHD came through, right, mm-hmm. and just crushed everything in that area to where I was reading like up to 80% of deer were killed by EHD. Which mm-hmm. is a crazy amount. Do you feel like something like that could happen across multiple species again, if not managed properly?
You know, I think Wyoming has some really good research on pronghorn that's coming out about this exact thing. Yeah, man. I mean, it just doesn't. It's been a problem. Diseases in particular have been a problem that we've studied, like from our agricultural perspective, mm-hmm. for hundreds of years. And it's what has informed a lot of the management decisions around chronic wasting disease, for example. I don't really want to get into the likelihood of someone, or like the opinions around whether we should use some sort of management decision or not for CWD. But the fact of the matter is, like, we know from our agricultural practices for hundreds of years, like, what things work and can eradicate diseases or reduce mm-hmm. their impact.
Yeah.
So to your point, man, I think, yeah, we got to be careful. We got to be real careful about how we let our populations get high.
Yeah. Okay. What else do we, of like some current events that have gone down that we need to discuss?
Man, a bunch of states have already done their leftover draws. And so now you're basically looking at like reissues or tags that are on the leftover lists. Mm-hmm. I think that the cool thing about a lot of these states, we just went through such a long time of, we just spent so much of this podcast like griping about tag draws and like mm-hmm. places that we can't go hunt, right?
Right.
But man, you still have over-the-counter opportunities in a lot of places. You've got landowner tag opportunities in some places. And, you know, there are just like, whether it's reissue, returns, you know, different secondary draws, like we just had this kind of phase go by. There's a lot of opportunity to be had. me and my best hunting buddy, we both have resident general tags in our home state for mule deer and elk and antelope for me. But we were trying to put together this hunt together and it didn't pan out. We had like four different applications we were pretty sure we had a good chance of. And moral of the story, we didn't get drawn for any of those. So then we go, well, crap, we're on plan like E or F, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And it's like, we've got over-the-counter tags in California. Let's go do it. You know, like never been there before in my life. I know it's going to be a grind. It's going to suck, but it's going to be a cool backcountry adventure. You know, the same things exist in Oregon and in Washington, in Utah, in Colorado. Like there's even some over-the-counter situations in Arizona for elk. So it's like pretty wild. There's places that people can get creative and still have hunts. And I think that's really exciting.
Yeah. Is there a state that stands out above all other states, or maybe three states that stand out that offer the most leftover options?
I think Colorado's return tag, like reissue list, I think is probably the most robust.
Yeah.
Followed closely by Idaho, but Idaho has like a, they've got a queue that happens every now and then. And I'll look it up while I'm talking about it because I think it's really helpful to go on there. It's pretty easy to get tags when they do have these reissues. But we just had an Idaho return on the 25th of last month. So we'll have to see when the next opportunity happens. I think it's in early August, so about a month out.
Gotcha. And so every once in a while, the state basically hits refresh on this list. And then it'll show you what units, what tags, what species are available for additional. Do these tags then go down in price?
Or are they're just the same.
Yeah. They're just available. Okay.
They're just available. Gotcha. Yeah. So I just looked it up. Idaho's is August 6th. So Colorado's kind of on a rolling basis doing reissues. And then, Idaho's is August 6th. The downside of that August 6th one is that residents can hop in and pick up tags too. So there's quite a bit of traffic on that one.
Gotcha.
But there's another return tag sale deadline on September 17th. And that one is really not well attended because it's in the middle of a lot of hunting seasons. But if you're still scrambling, maybe you want to come out for an October hunt or something the next month, like it's a good place to be looking.
Yeah. Or if you're already out there for a different species, you tag out on day one and you just so happen to be out there, you can grab that tag and go after a different species while you're already out there.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And this is to say too, like, man, there's still a lot of fall black bear hunting that has is still over the counter, basically in most every Western state at some level. Mm-hmm. So if you really are totally out of luck but you really want to hunt like in a specific area to get to know it for future, I like those fall black bear hunts quite a bit too.
Yeah, I like that, what you just said. It's almost like a setup where I don't have any experience hunting black bear. Okay. But I would go hunt black bear in the elk unit that I ultimately want at some point to get to know it better. Right. And so maybe that I have a tag in my pocket would motivate me to go out and, you know, run through that unit. But then at the same time, ultimately what I'm there for is the knowledge of that unit for my elk tag.
Yeah, 100%, man. Yeah. I think it's some people are starting to pick up on doing that and like realizing that when they draw a good tag, you actually do need to know something about the country before you really just go in and have a bunch of success. So if you're time limited on a year-to-year basis, man, go make best use of that time when you're not having a fancy tag in your pocket.
Absolutely. Man, we covered a lot today. Is there anything else that is worth discussing today? That the listeners would be interested in knowing.
Man, at the end of all of this, it's such an exciting part of the year. Like, you know, most people are either got their season set or they're in this backup mode, like I was just talking about and like trying to figure it out. It's fun. And maybe it's just fun for me. I don't know about you, but like, I like this whole planning process so much. I mean, I've made a career out of it literally, but it's so fun because you get a, you get to get excited about these upcoming adventures and like what an adventure these hunts can be. So it's been great. I just had a conversation with my brother and my friend Hayden. I have a pronghorn tag that like is going to be a really good pronghorn tag in Eastern Oregon. Didn't expect to get it. And I'm so excited to go bounce around in the pickup with my brother and my nephew and go try to get a pronghorn. Followed shortly thereafter with a grind of an over-the-counter backpack hunt, right? Like you get both the dichotomies, and both of those things have their own way of being exciting. So the planning phase is fun, man. Don't lose sight of that. Like this whole hunting thing should be enjoyable.
Absolutely, dude. Well, first off, thank you very much for taking time out of your day. If people want to find out more about your business, what you do, and some of the research that you do, where do we need to send them?
Yeah, just go to huntwestplanning.com. That's where you guys can look up information about like the services and stuff. Got like a weekly Sunday email that I've been sending out a bunch of called the Hunt West Digest too. So if you like a quick read that helps you get better at Western hunting or thinking about Western hunting, that's a good place to go check it out.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Thanks,
man. All right, dude. Jaden, man, as always, I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure.